Well, so I may be
more coherent
than usual, so
if I'm not being clear, let me know. So in the first lecture, we started by having a discussion on conformal theories and how they fit in the, how they're essential to our understanding of quantum field theory. And since I see some new faces, maybe I'll just say a few highlights of yesterday's lecture and then I'll continue with the rest of the motivation of why CFTs are important. And, well, hopefully today at the end of the lecture, maybe tomorrow, we'll start with the details of what are the symmetries, what are some formal symmetries, and how we characterize them, and so on. So, just to recapitulate, there are actually two main qualitative reasons why conformal field theories are central to our understanding of quantum field theory. One is more a structural one, having to do with how we think about quantum physics in general. And the global vehicle is that conformal field theories are the, if you wish, the scaffolding in the space of quantum field theories, of all quantum field theories, conformal or not. Most conformal field theories, most quantum field theories are not conformal. But nevertheless, our point was that you can think of an arbitrary quantum field theory by starting with a conformal field theory and deforming it away by some relevant operator. And the basic idea here was that this picture of flow, renormalization group flows. If I write too small, let me know because, but I think it should be okay. In the space of couplings. So remember that here the idea was is that we start with a low energy set of degrees of freedom, and we write down the most general, we use what's called the Wilsonian picture of renormalization. You write down the most general set of operator or interactions that you can write down. And then these couplings obey some renormalization group flow, which are determined by the beta function. So you have the derivative of some energy scale, of the coupling with respect to some energy scale, and you put the E here to pick up the scaling dimension, equals a nonlinear function of all the other couplings. So this is an equation that in principle involves an infinite number of couplings, because for a given set of fields, you can write down an infinite number of fields of operators. You just multiply them together, take derivatives, and so on. And these flow equations in the space of couplings . So this is just some dynamical system, you think. You can think of it as in terms of an auxiliary dynamical system. And the point is that this dynamical system, the existence of fixed points. So the first point is that when you study something like this, it's useful to first isolate what are the fixed points of a dynamical system. And these are the zeros of the beta function. So these are solutions that satisfy this equation. And since this is the variation of the coupling with respect to the energy scale, and what we're seeing is that there is no variation at the fixed point. This way was this important for us, because this defines points where this happens, define a conformal field theory. Because the theory at that point is a scale invariant and unconformal invariant. Okay, so now let me draw a little bit more of a picture. So remember that the point was that we had this, in the space of couplings, we had this, this kind of pictures. So, okay, maybe I should use some color to distinguish. So imagine I have some flow that has three fixed points. Emanating from each fixed point, there is a set of coordinates in the space of fields, of operators, that parameterize the deformations away from the fixed point. And we saw you can have flows of this type. So this would be something like this. So you can have here, for example,
a direction that pushes you away from the fixed point as you go to the infrared. Remember that the direction of the arrow is flowing towards low energies. And this is what we call the relevant interaction. These are the ones that are large and important, or most important, in the infrared. And you can also have a situation like that. So imagine this is a particular flow, just to give an example, different from yesterday. So this guy is kind of a completely unstable fixed point because you're flowing. Imagine that we're focusing in this two-dimensional subspace, and you have two directions that are flowing away from the fixed point, and they flow to yet another fixed point here. So this would be 1, 2, and 3. And then you can draw some trajectories here. So you could have all kinds of trajectories like that, okay? And you can think of any quantum field theory in this space as arising from tuning, starting from one of the fixed points towards that point, okay? So that's why, if you wish, I mean, these conformal field theories are kind of the beams that hold the space of quantum field theories together. So understanding them is crucial in understanding how the space of field theories and how couplings flow in that space. So that's why they are important. Okay. So now, so this was a fair motivation. This was more perhaps conceptual, having to do with our understanding of quantum field theory. The more traditional answer of why conformal field theories are important. So this was point one. Point two is that actually conformal field theories are directly relevant for nature. And there are two types of systems that are controlled by conformal field theories. The more traditional one that you might have heard in your statistical physics course is that they describe critical phenomena in statistical mechanics or condensed matter physics. So these are phase transitions. So this is a phenomenon that happens very generically in physical systems. It happens in liquids, it happens in magnets, and so on. But the ones that are relevant for conformal field theories are phase transitions that are continuous. Sometimes they're called second order or higher. And these are, I'll describe them in a bit more detail what I mean by this, but the point is that these systems are described by a set of degrees of freedom that have correlations between the basic degrees of freedom, like spins, at arbitrary large distances. So as you approach a critical point, by tuning some parameter, so if you're an experimental, you have to tune parameters to go to these fixed points, to these critical points. As you tune the parameters, what happens is the correlation length between the basic degrees of freedom grows unbounded, and therefore in that limit you get a scale invariant and therefore conformal invariance. So that's why critical phenomena are described by conformal field theories. And one of the important subjects in critical phenomena is to actually calculate or determine how the various thermodynamic quantities that we compute and measure actually scale as a function of the parameter that you have to tune as you approach the fixed point. And these critical exponents that tell you how things behave are directly related to something that we will study in the course, which is to the study of the dimensions of operators in conformal field theories. Essentially, the spectrum of dimensions of operators in a CFT give you the critical exponents, which is the things, the quantities that experimentalists measure. Okay? So that's the traditional use of conformal field theory in critical phenomena. Notice that in this context, we're always thinking of phase transitions that happens at non-zero temperature. So these are transitions which are driven by thermal fluctuations. Okay. But it turns out that there is, more recently, it has become very popular to study yet another type of transitions that happen at zero temperature and that also that are also described by a conformal field theory. And these are called quantum critical points. And I'll give you examples of both today and, of course, later on in the lecture also, in the lectures. So these are transitions, phase transitions, that also exhibit infinite correlation lengths that happens at zero temperature. So these transitions, unlike these ones, which were driven by thermal fluctuations, here the transition is driven by quantum fluctuations. And here, just like in the case of the more familiar, probably to you, phase transitions, here we have to tune some external parameter like temperature, pressure, magnetic field, something like that. Here, in order to reach this point where, which is in fact one of these fixed points, where you have a scale invariance, you have to tune a parameter in the Hamiltonian of your quantum system. And I'll give you perhaps the simplest example of a quantum Hamiltonian that exhibits this kind of interesting behavior. So these two classes of systems, which in fact are realized in nature at the critical point, are described by various CFTs. And some of them actually are CFTs. So for some of the simplest models, some of the CFTs that will appear are actually CFTs that we're going to solve. And we're going to solve them not by starting from the statistical mechanics system, but by directly going to the continuum quantum field theory that lives at the fixed point. And therefore, we'll be able to calculate exactly the critical exponents for various statistical systems, which is one of the great successes of the subject, to really calculate from first principles these critical exponents. People got Nobel Prizes for this thing, so it's a big deal. Okay. So let me now say maybe a little bit more about the two cases so that we are all in the same language. I suppose that some of these things that I'm saying you've already seen in the statistical mechanics course, but I think it's good maybe for people that didn't take that course that we're all in the same page. So any questions? Okay. So the... Notice that one of the things I was saying there in order to characterize a phase transition is that whenever you have a quantum system with many degrees of freedom, you can define... Hello? Can people in the TV hear me? Thumbs up if you can, thumbs down if you cannot. Oh, was that a thumb? I hope it's the right finger. Okay. Okay. Okay, can you ask questions if you need to ask one? I cannot hear anything, but... okay. Excuse me? No, it's 2009. So it started already. Okay. Maybe it's a... But, okay, I'll continue and they can... watch the rest of the lecture. Okay. So, I was saying something. Yes, I was saying that one of the important ingredients that tells us whether a system is approaching criticality, one of these fixed points where you have a scale invariant, is this notion of correlation length, which we call zeta, or psi, I guess. Intuitively, this is the thing, if you have a large number of degrees of freedom that interact locally with each other, the correlation length, roughly speaking, tells you how far the influence of a spin here, or of a basic degrees of freedom here, how correlated it is, what is the length at which degrees of freedom are still correlated, okay? So that they feel each other's influence very strongly. So if you wish, it's kind of a measure of how in tune the various degrees of freedom are. And so this was an intuitive definition. A more fundamental, or the way you would calculate this in a given system, would be, for example, by computing the two-point function of the basic degrees of freedom of your system. So if we were studying magnets, you would ask, how does the spin of an atom here, how correlated it is with the spin of an atom far away? Or if you are thinking of the liquid gas transition, you would ask how much the density is correlated as you move inside the sample. So mathematically, the way you can define this correlation length is that you measure, we call by sigma the basic degree of freedom. So we could call it phi if we want to use the language of the last lecture, but I want to use sigma here because it's the usual notation for spins. So you ask, you compute the connected two-point function, and typically the correlation length will go something like this. You can read off from this behavior. You take the points large apart, and then you measure the exponential fall-off of the correlation function. Notice that, this kind of behavior in two-point functions is something that you're very familiar with, because you're familiar with the Yukawa potential, or another way, maybe more formally, the way to say it is that if you compute the two-point function of a massive scalar field, the behavior of the two-point function this case exponentially with a length scale. So you have a massive scalar field of mass m, and you compute this quantity, what you find is that the correlation length is 1 over the mass. Is this something that people know? Okay. Very good. Notice, so now what we were saying is that in order to hit the phase transition, you have to tune some external parameter. So these are the knobs that an experimentalist would have in his or her lab. So like pressure, a magnetic field, temperature. Okay? And what you do is you tune this parameter in such a way that as you reach a critical point, so let's say as the temperature approaches the critical temperature, the correlation length goes to infinity. Then you get a critical behavior. Notice that this connects with our discussion yesterday, that we said that any theory that's conformally invariant or scale invariant cannot have a dimension-full parameter. But notice that as we reach the critical point, the correlation length of the system is going to infinity, and therefore the corresponding mass scale is going to zero, so you have a massless scale invariant theory. So what happens in this system is that as you approach the critical point, as you approach the critical point, there is no intrinsic length scale anymore, and you have a scale invariant. So it's described by a conformal field theory. So let me give you now one example or two of such systems that you presumably have seen before. And this kind of, the way to fish for critical points, you can see them by looking at the phase diagram of various physical systems. So you look at the phase diagram of something. So an example would be to look at the phase diagram of ferromagnets. Okay. As a function of the magnetic field and the temperature, which are two things that you can play with. So there are many ways of drawing these things, but this is something presumably you've seen. If not, I can elaborate, but let me just quickly go through this. So you study the system. So this is, you can think of it as a toy model for this is the Ising model. You have a whole bunch of spins on a lattice where the atoms sit. And you apply to it temperature, and you can change the temperature in the magnetic field. And you ask what is the macroscopic magnetization of the sample. So something that probably you know from undergraduate physics is that if you take iron and you heat it to very large temperature, it has a phase transition from something that's magnetized to something that's not magnetized. And this is the TC. C stands for critical, but in this case also for Curie transition. This is called the Curie transition. And this is a situation. OK, so now let me explain a bit more detail. So this is the point in parameter space that you would have a conformal field theory, where you would have one of these second order, in this case, the second order phase transition. Along this line, okay, let me just chalk again. We don't have many colors here. It's really bad. OK. You have this line that goes from zero temperature to TC. As you know, if you're at very low temperatures and you have a ferromagnet, the spins like to be aligned. So you're in the ordered phase. So spins like to go together. But what happens here along this line is that essentially in the Ising model, you have either spin up or spin down. So depending, you can change the macroscopic behavior of the magnet by just turning on a very small magnetic field. So just above this line, by turning on some magnetic field, the macroscopic magnetization will be positive and here will be negative. So this means that across this line, you have what is the first order phase transition, where the basic variable, macroscopic variable, jams discontinuously. Okay? The critical point that is the one that exhibits scale invariance is the end point of this line of first order phase transition. And there, actually, here, that's why it's called continuous. The magnetization does not jump discontinuously at the second order phase transition. Therefore, that's the origin of the name. But something else happens. So instead of having a singularity for the magnetization, what you have is in a second order phase transition, at T equals TC, you have a singularity for another thermodynamic quantity that is related to the free energy. So a basic concept in statistical physics is the concept of free energy, which you have definitely seen. And roughly speaking, the first order phase transition is a transition that has a discontinuity on an observable, which is related to the first derivative of the free energy. That's why it's called first order. While a second order phase transition is related to discontinuity of, or a singularity more generally, of an observable, which is related to the second derivative of the free energy. Okay, in this case, would be something like that. Okay, so in this particular case, you would get a singularity for the magnetic something called the magnetic susceptibility. Okay? So this will exhibit a very interesting singularity, which is the thing that we're going to calculate and people measure. Should I say more about this? Maybe not. This kind of picture that I drew is kind of very generic. It happens, a similar type of phase transition happens when you study water and you look at the phase diagram of water, so you have pressure and temperature. It has a phase diagram like that. So you have here at very high temperatures and low pressures, you like to be a gas. At high pressures and low temperatures, you like to be a solid. And here you like to be a liquid. And this phase diagram exhibits a phase transition, one of the second order phase transition. Between the gas and liquid phase at some temperature and pressure, well, this is. Just so that we know what we're talking about, can someone tell me roughly, I mean, just order of magnitude, what is the critical temperature for a ferromagnet? I mean, up to factors of 10 or 100 or something. Yeah, something like, it's more like, I think it's more like 6,000, but yeah, that's it. So here would be like, and what about here? For the critical point of the liquid gas transition of water? Just, I mean, the 10 degrees, 100 degrees, minus 20, I mean. Is it high or small or, well, okay, it's pretty, yes, okay. But how? I think, actually I'm making it up, but I think it's roughly like 600. Maybe you would know that it's around 600. I think something like that, 600 Celsius. It's pretty high. It's not something you can easily do in your stove. But actually, if you go to YouTube, is it? Yeah. So if you go to YouTube, you can see pictures of this phase transition. It's actually very nice because there's a phenomenon that happens in second order phase transitions, which actually is a very physical phenomenon. It's the statement that as you approach the critical point, you have fluctuations at all length scales. So what happens is that since you have fluctuations at all length scales, because of the way light reflects on that sample, the near that point, the sample looks like white. It looks like milk, essentially. So you can see it with your naked eye that as you watch the video, something funny will happen here, and it will start looking like milk, essentially. I think that's called critical opalescence, opalescence, or some permutation of those words. I don't know how exactly to spell it. Okay, so very good. Yes.
We have both first and second order transitions and a form.
Sorry.
We have both first and second order transitions and a form.
No, it's either no. So here it's second order transition.
It's
the boundary.
For some, I don't know, example.
I don't think so, no. You could have weirder things. You could have multi-critical points. There are infinitely rich thing kind of things that you can have. You can have a line of second order phase transitions that ends, or let's call it a critical point. And in fact, we will study those in CFD because in two-dimensional CFTs, it's easy to construct models of this type where you could have all kinds of exotic phase conditions. And they seem to be relevant for nature, so that's even better. Okay. So one last comment about this. Here I was focusing on magnets. But I also mentioned that these things happen here. So now you could have asked, so imagine I'm an experimenter and I study things here, and I study things here. If you look at a microscopic Hamiltonian of this and that, you would say this is completely different. They have nothing to do with each other. But now, actually, a prediction of all my slogans yesterday about how to do quantum field theory, which actually bears out experimentally, is the idea that, I mean, that's the basic prediction of this idea of renormalization group, is that even though you started with a crazy Hamiltonian up there that can be very different, remember that I was saying here, or yesterday, that you start with a complicated system at low energies, at high energies, but the behavior at long distances is controlled by a few parameters, by a few operators, which are the relevant and marginal operators. So even though you could have started with something which is completely different, like here and here, at very large distances, which is what we're studying here, because we're studying systems that exhibit a macroscopic correlation line, as long as the systems have the same low energy degree of freedom, which in this case would be the magnetization, and in this case would be the density, which is the basic variable that fluctuates, this story tells us that the behavior near the fixed point of these two different systems that you studied up there is very similar. And experimentally, kind of the qualitative prediction that this tells you is that the critical exponents of systems that have same symmetry and are described with the same basic degrees of freedom, they exhibit the same critical exponent. And that's something that really happens. If you look at the critical exponent of this transition and this transition, they're very similar. Even though they're measuring very different things. So here you are, for example, measuring the singularity for magnetic susceptibility, while here you're measuring the singularity, I think it's called compressibility. It's the second derivative of the free energy with respect to pressure, okay? And this is kind of a big success of the idea of normalization group that, and it goes under the name of universality. And it's one of the basic qualitative predictions of these ideas of the normalization group. For example, I think Peskin has a table in some chapter, I forget, in Physical Phenomena, where he lists the various critical exponents that I'll go through now more carefully for various samples that have nothing to do with each other, and you see that they're tantalizingly the same. And the way we understand that is because of this idea that even though you started very different upstairs, by the time you're downstairs, there's a unique effective field theory describing that system. Okay, any questions about this story? I'm going very slow as usual, but that's life, I guess. Okay. So now, let's try to understand in more detail what are the things that we want to determine in order to characterize a critical point. So the first thing to say is that phase transitions are characterized by non-analyticities or singularities of macroscopic thermodynamic quantities as magnetization, density, magnetic susceptibility, compressibility, so on. What did I say here? Quantities. Okay? So actually this is a nice subject where if I give you a function, the important part of the function has to do with the singularities. It's good when the physical information is encoded in singularities because it's easy to fish out for singularities if I give you a function. And the way you, just to remind you, how you compute these thermodynamic quantities is that you always start with the partition function of the system. Here you sum over all states that your microscopic system has. So imagine you have an Ising system. You have a spin at its lattice side, so you can have a spin up or spin down. And you sum over all possible configurations weighted by some Hamiltonian divided by the temperature, where this Hamiltonian will be a function of the basic variables
spins, densities, whatever, magnetic field, pressure, the external parameters, okay? And this, by definition, so this was the partition function, right? And this is the free energy. Okay. And all thermodynamic quantities can be obtained by essentially starting from the free energy and taking derivatives with respect to the control parameters. So in a way, if you know the free energy, you know everything. If you know the free energy as a function of all these parameters, of course. So just to give you an example, for example, the magnetization is a derivative of the free energy with respect to some external magnetic field that you apply to the system. That will be magnetization. This is the quantity that is discontinuous across this line of first order phase transitions. And then we can define the magnetic susceptibility, chi, which is the second derivative with respect to B. And if you want to be careful, you have to put some powers. Or in this case, I don't have to put any. So it's the mu, the derivative of the magnetization with respect to the magnetic field. So it's kind of the second derivative of the free energy with this magnetic field. So mathematically, if you wish, we can think of the various thermodynamic quantities in terms of how many derivatives we have to take with respect to the control parameter, which in this case is magnetization. So in a setting a continuous phase transition, the first derivative is discontinuous. And in a second order phase transition, this guy has a singularity. Okay? That's one crude way of characterizing the different types of phase transitions we can have. And now, since I already said that near the critical point we have this scaling behavior, all thermodynamic quantities exhibit homogeneity or scaling behavior. Is it me being sick or is it very hot here? I don't know. Is it hot? Yeah? Okay. So this gives rise to critical exponents, which tells us how the various quantities behave near the critical point. So the first one, so there's a whole list you can define. Let me just write a few. So remember that I said that one way of fishing out for a critical point is to make sure that the correlation length goes to infinity so that you have no intrinsic mass scale. And since as you approach the critical point, the correlation length goes to infinity, you can define a critical exponent like that that tells you that psi blows up as t approaches tc. And it blows up because, okay, I'm assuming here that nu is positive. Okay? That's one type of critical exponent. In a second order phase transition, I said that the magnetization is continuous, so but you can fish out how it behaves near the phase transition. And you can define the critical exponent beta that tells you how the magnetization goes to zero as you approach the critical point. You can also do the same thing as a function of the magnetic field. As you turn on the magnetic field, the magnetization goes to zero, but with some prescribed behavior. And then you have the singular terms, like the, for example, the heat capacity. So the heat capacity, the way you would define the heat capacity, so can someone tell me how the heat capacity is determined from the partition function? This you've seen, I'm pretty sure. How is the energy determined from the partition function?
Huh?
Yes. Yeah, so the energy is roughly speaking df dt. You might have to put some power of p here, you want to be careful, but just to bring down the right thing. And then the heat capacity is the derivative of the energy with respect to the temperature. So roughly speaking, is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to the temperature. Okay, so you can define near the second of phase transition, the second derivative it becomes singular, and you can define another physical exponent. So it's T minus Tc minus alpha, which is tells you how it blows up, how the heat capacity blows up as you approach the critical point. And finally, you can define, and this is related to a problem that you're going to study today, of how you define anomalous dimensions. So essentially, you compute the two-point function of the basic variables of the system. So for the Ising system would be the spin. And since you have a scaling behavior, you know that it scales not anymore as an exponential, because you have no dimension full scale to soak up the distance here. So it falls out like a power, x to the z minus 2 plus eta. So d is the dimension of the system, and eta is the critical exponent. In quantum theory jargon, this is the anomalous dimension. Notice that a scalar field in d dimensions has dimensions d minus 2 over 2, as you hopefully saw yesterday. So this part is exactly the term that you would get in free field theory. And this is a correction that tells you the exact dimension of the operator. Typically, we can only study this eta in perturbation theory, but in some conformal field theories, because we have a lot of powerful techniques, we can just compute exactly what this quantity is. And this will be one of the subjects later on in the course.
Okay, how did that come about? That last thing that you wrote, the two-point function.
This is fixed by a scaling variant.
There's something that there is no scale. So the point is that when you approach the critical point, everything is a homogeneous function of a scale transformation. And this is the homogeneous function you can have of the distance. That knows about the dimension of sigma. That's, in fact, how you define the dimension of sigma. That you look at the coefficient of this power law, essentially. Okay. So these are the quantities that we're very interested in determining experimentally and theoretically. And for some simple toy models, we will likely compute them, like for the Ising model. Okay, so now let me go to point B. Not yet. Let me just give you very quickly a microscopic Hamiltonian that exhibits critical behavior that you know, hopefully well, which is the two-dimensional Ising model, or the three-dimensional Ising model. But So this is a lattice model in two dimensions, where you have atoms in a two-dimensional lattice. Here I drew it rectangular, but it could be some other thing. And on each side here, you have a spin variable sigma I that can be either plus or minus 1. And the Hamiltonian that defines your path integral, your Hamiltonian is minus J, which is some energy scale that tells you the cost of flipping a spin. So is there just by dimensional analysis? And in the simplest versions of the Ising model, what you have is an interaction. Okay, let me write it like this. So, okay, like that. So IJ, which tells you that a given spin here has an interaction with all the neighboring spins. This thing means nearest neighbor interaction. So this spin would interact with this guy, and this guy. And at low temperatures, this interaction induces the spins to be aligned. And that's why the Ising model is a good model of a ferromagnet. Okay? And this interesting lattice model has a critical point, which I believe you've seen, which happens at a particular value of the temperature, or J, essentially. You can rescale, you can define a dimensionless ratio, which is J over T, and that's the quantity that you tune. And this system has a second order phase transition. When I believe sine sinh of 2k critical equals 1. Okay? And one of the things that we will do is study all these fancy critical exponents at the critical point of the Ising model, but not using this lattice description. That's kind of the point of the remodulation group. Doing it this here, using the spin picture, short distance picture, would be very hard, even though people have done it. It's one of the few exactly solvable models in the statistical physics. But instead, we will use the fact that we know the symmetries of the system, and we can identify what conformal field theory we have in the extreme infrared, and we will compute it there. And actually, since in this case you can compute it independently from the lattice system, you will see that you get exact agreement between the field theory analysis and the lattice model analysis. And so this is just one example. There is an infinitely rich class of statistical systems in two dimensions that are controlled by completely different critical phenomena, which I mean by that is that these are critical points that have completely different values of these parameters. So this one jargon you could use is these different conformal field theories characterize different universality classes in that language I was saying before. When I was saying that the water vapor transition and the magnet transition are in the same universality class, that means that they had the same type of exponents. In two dimensions, you have an infinitely large class of universality classes, which are controlled by two-dimensional conformal field theories, and we'll study some of them concretely. And it turns out that people have, some of them before, some of them after this revolution in two-dimensional CFTs, there are corresponding microscopic lattice models that you can show have a critical point with precisely the critical exponents that is predicted by the conformal field theory. So there's a very nice interplay between lattice models and continuum models in two dimensions. Also in higher dimensions, but in higher dimensions it's much harder to solve. And we will see soon why two-dimensional CFTs are very, very special, and that's why we can solve them. Any questions so far? No? Okay, so far I was talking about point A there, which are phase transitions that are driven by thermal fluctuations. So these are transitions that happen at non-zero temperature. Now let me say a couple of things about this more fancier, now more popular quantum critical points, which are phase transitions. So let me see what I can erase. That happens at zero temperature. So let's describe a little bit, just briefly, quantum critical points. Okay, so as I said, these are transitions with infinite correlation length that happen at zero temperature. Okay? So one of the requirements that these requires is that the, so you have a Hamiltonian, this is the energy of the ground state. And typically, you don't have a spectrum of excitations. And a length scale that any quantum system has is the length scale that's characterized by delta, which is the energy gap. This is the energy scale between the ground state of the system and the first excited state. Since this is an energy scale, by dimensional analysis, it defines a length scale. Okay? So clearly, one way that you something that you have to tune in order to get a system which is conformally invariant and has infinite correlation length. Again, the correlation length is, roughly speaking, proportional to 1 over delta. So in order to get a system that has a quantum critical point, what you have to do is you have to tune the parameters of your Hamiltonian such that the energy gap closes. And delta goes to 0. And this is possible to do in some systems. Okay? And when that happens, in that regime is described by a conformal field theory. So let me give you a couple of simple examples. So the third example, since in this course we will deal to some large extent with two-dimensional conformal field theories, because they are the ones that we can characterize more completely, in order to get a quantum critical point described by a d-dimensional quantum field theory, your quantum system has to be in one dimension less. I know you've seen that. I mean, hopefully, I know François David spent some time explaining how quantum systems in d dimensions, special dimensions, are described by field theories in d plus one dimension. So if I want a system, a quantum critical point described by a two-dimensional CFT, we have to look at quantum systems in one special dimension. And one nice model of this, which also played an important role not only in understanding magnetism, but also had many important ramifications for more formal aspects of physics, like is related to the subject of integrability of some Hamiltonians, is the Heisenberg Heisenberg spin chain Hamiltonian in one dimension. So here what you should think about is you have a system living on a circle. This is your one-dimensional system. And it's a lattice system. So again, you have spins living at these sites. And now, at each point of the system here, you have a quantum spin variable. Okay? And the system that exhibits this quantum orthogonal behavior is actually the anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg spin chain. So this is one that likes spins to be anti-aligned as opposed to aligned. And it's described by a Hamiltonian, which is J, the sum over all sides on the circle, Si, the spin. So I'll explain this better. So I plus 1. Where you have this, and this is a minus sign. Let me see. No, like that, yeah. Where Si are essentially the Pauli matrices. So at each lattice side, you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space of a spin. And Si are essentially the Pauli matrices. Okay, sorry. So I labels the site, so, and then I should put another index here. This is a three vector, so let me call it with components, what's a good name? A. So I goes from 1 to n. This is the number of lattice sites. And A goes from 1 to 3, which are essentially three polymatrices, okay? So where sigma 1 is this, just to be concrete, sigma 2 is this, and sigma 3 is this. So this completely characterizes the Hamiltonian of the system. And this system can be completely solved, and that's something that Bethe did a gazillion years ago using what's called the Bethe ansatz. And it's a system that exhibits exactly this kind of behavior. It has a zero gap, has a gapless spectrum, and is described by a quantum critical, sorry, by a two-dimensional conformal field theory, which actually I think hopefully we will also discuss in the course. So let me tell you a couple of very briefly what the CFT is. It turns out that since this system has an obvious SU2 symmetry, because remember that the three polymatrices generate an SU2 commutation relation, the conformal field theory will have to have an SU2 symmetry. So the So that's why symmetries are very powerful to constrain what kind of, and define what kind of critical conformal field theory we have to describe. So the critical behavior, it can be set in several ways. Ones that are useful for some purposes, some that are useful for some others. But one that is kind of the most pedestrian language, which will not make it totally opaque, is that this will be described as a two-dimensional free boson. But where the boson, the scalar field, has a periodicity. So you have a scalar field phi of x. But this phi of x, if you wish, you can think of it as parametrizing a circle. You make periodic identifications. And this conformal field theory that describes the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg spin chain is one where the radius is what's called the self-dual radius, okay? Now, something that you might worry is that when you have a single scalar field, there is only an obvious U1 symmetry in the system. But in fact, the point is that at this value of the radius, there is a hidden SU2 symmetry. And in the course, we will see actually how to demonstrate that if you take a free boson in two dimensions at the self-dual radius, we'll be able to generate a SU2 symmetry algebra. There's another description that unfortunately, I will not probably get to it during the course, but is a very powerful set of theories that has incredible large number of applications. Is that this same theory has a dual description, which means an alternative description, but is exactly the same theory as something that I'll mention the word in case you ever come across about it. It's called an SU2, something called a Wessel-Minow-Witten model at level 1. Okay? And this is kind of the simplest class of theories in this infinite class of conformal field theories that are described by these Wessel-Minow-Witten model theories, okay? So I don't know if I'll get to that during the course, but definitely we will study this picture. The bad thing about this picture is that it doesn't make the SU2 symmetry manifest. The nice thing about this picture is that it makes the SU2 symmetry manifest, but then, well, the downside for me is that in order to tell you about this, I would have a long detour, but this one will definitely go, okay? And finally, the last system that exhibits quantum critical behavior that we will also study is the quantum Ising model in one dimension in a transverse magnetic field. I'm sweating like crazy. Okay, and this is described by a Hamiltonian. It's also, you can think of it as a system living on a circle, just like this one, where you have a sum over all the lattice types times sigma iz, exactly the kind of polymetric I was having there, sigma iz, sigma i1z. So again, it's only nearest neighbor interactions. It has a coupling constant j here. And it has a transverse magnetic field, which means that I have a parameter here, g, which I can tune, that couples, you can think of it as a magnetic field, that couples to the spin x variable. That's what it's called transverse. So you have a spins pointing this way, and you apply a magnetic field that way. So that's why you couple to sigma x and not sigma z. And something that you can establish, well, this model is also exactly soluble, but something that you can establish without very much effort is to, in fact, notice that this system also has a quantum critical point. And the quantum critical point here, where the gap, the spectrum is typically gapped, so it certainly cannot be described by a CFT, but you get a quantum critical point at g equals 1. So at this point, so you, if you're an experimentalist, you would tune this parameter g. This is not only a fantasy. Actually, people that do atom traps are able to essentially design any spin Hamiltonian that you want by playing around with magnetic fields and fancy stuff. So they can really do this. They can really do this. And the point is that in this case, the quantum critical point at g equals 1 will be described by a two-dimensional conformal field theory. There we had a free boson in two dimensions, a compact free boson in two dimensions. Here the two-dimensional conformal theory is described by a free fermion in two dimensions. And both this theory and that theory is something that we can solve rather easily. And by doing simple calculations, we can get all the exponents that you would want. Okay, so these are the... Any questions about this? So maybe I'll just finish in the last few minutes. So these are the two core motivations, to me at least, why CFT is important, because it's central to quantum field theory and because it describes all these interesting physics of phase transitions, which is something that happens in nature, very generically. There are also other motivations which I think interesting, and in the last few minutes I will tell you a little bit about them. Some of them are a bit more formal, but the reason I want to mention them is that this is a bit of an appetizer for things that you will see in later courses. And so that when you get to those courses, you can give the lecturer a hard time. So one motivation, which is more of a... in a way... tell you which is the what's special about conformal field theories is that there is a theorem that has a certain, it's an important theorem that actually who did this? I should know this. Well, the statement of the theorem is that a quantum field theory, the maximal symmetry, the maximal space-time symmetry of a quantum field theory is actually precisely the conformal group. So this is, I think, an important statement because space-time is kind of a basic object where things happen. And Einstein told us about Poincaré told us about Poincaré symmetry, but Einstein kind of made manifest that we should use that Poincaré is the symmetry of flat space-time. So it's a very natural question to ask how symmetric can a quantum field theory possibly be? And this is the, well, of course, as in all theorems, there is a set of assumptions that go into this. And in fact, one way of getting around this assumption is what led to supersymmetry. But roughly speaking, the statement is that if you want to have a theory, and here I'm cheating a little bit, but it's for your benefit, not to be, I don't want to be malicious, but it's for, I'm not giving you all the details of, there's a loop, there's a, one has to be careful in applying this theorem to massless theories, but it can be superincumbented, no problem. And it is a detail that is not very important for us right now. But the basic idea is that if you say, imagine you want to study a theory, a scattering of particles in the quantum field theory, essentially the statement is that if the S matrix is to be non-trivial, the maximal symmetry space-time symmetry you can have is the conformal group. If you had any more symmetry, the S matrix would be trivial, which means not interesting from our point of view. Okay? So that means that whatever you ever do, the most symmetric that a non-trivial quantum field theory will be a conformal field theory. So this is interesting because usually in physics, if you have symmetry, we can do more than if we don't have symmetry. So this tells us that if you want to understand quantum field theory, let's study the most symmetric one, which is a conformal field theory. So here I have to make a parenthesis. One way around this, which is very interesting, is that there is a loophole in this argument, in the assumption of the theorem, which in fact, if you incorporate them, tells you that in fact, the most symmetric theory, and you have a course on supersymmetry, so you can ask him how to circumvent this. The most symmetric theory is in fact a supersymmetric conformal field theory. Supersymmetry is also a space-time symmetry that acts on our beloved space-time, but also acts in some extra, if you wish, quantum coordinates, fermionic coordinates. And the statement is that if you allow your symmetry generators to be anti-commuting, the most general, most symmetric theory is a supersymmetric conformal field theory. And in particular, in that list, the simplest, using this language of symmetry to characterize simplicity, the simplest four-dimensional quantum field theory is something that you will hear again later in your lectures when you study ADCFT and probably when you study supersymmetry, is four-dimensional n equals 4 super Young Mills, which is a theory that this fancy thing is just a statement that it has a certain set of supersymmetries. And it happens that this theory is also a conformal field theory. So this is a supersymmetric conformal field theory, also known as a superconformal field theory. And this will play an important role when you study ADS-CFT correspondence. It's kind of the simplest and by far most well understood of the relation between quantum gravity in ADS and field theory. Okay. So since they're the simplest theories to study, we will study them. The second motivation is that, actually, even though I presented for pedagogical reasons in this way, it turns out that conformal field theories can be defined without referring to a Lagrangian. In fact, what we will see is that you can essentially completely solve a conformal field theory without ever talking about Lagrangians. All that you have to do is impose certain consistency conditions on your theory that are sufficiently powerful to completely characterize all correlation functions just from the knowledge. All that you need to know, if you give me the data of the spectrum of the theory, and the three-point functions, So essentially, what is the behavior of three operators? O now is an abstract operator. It could be related to O of phi like yesterday, but it need not be at all related to that. If you give me these two data, you can, using what's called the conformal bootstrap, which I'll explain in the lecture, of course, we can calculate everything. Using a kind of a Feynman, quote-unquote Feynman diagram picture, but where the Feynman diagrams do not arise from any Lagrangian, but just as a way of splitting higher point functions in terms of basic building blocks, which are the three-point functions. Yes? Because any higher, the point is that any higher point function, so if I give you an n-point function, you can chop up, you can factorize an n-point function into product of three-point functions. So let me give you an example. Imagine I give you a four-point function. So I have 4 points. I have operator O1, O2, O3, O4. It turns out that you can calculate this by, so to explain this in detail, I will do it later, but just to get a picture, you can insert, you certainly can compute this by inserting a complete set of states. Like in quantum mechanics, if I have an operator, I can insert the identity there, and the identity is a resolution of all the states in the Hilbert space. So you can compute this by inserting here the identity operator. So here I have a sum over all states in the theory, so over all states. The spectrum with the theory in the conformal field theory is the same as saying the you know exactly the Hilbert space of the theory. And what you do is you can compute it like that. So you have here point 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and here you're summing over all states. So you can reduce the computation of the four-point function to the computation of the product of 2 3-point functions. And that's true. I mean, you can just do the exercise. Write the 5-point function. You can chop it up in a way that it's the basic building block is just product of 3-point functions. Yes?
Yeah, in the 5-4 theory, how would this be possible to test 3-point functions?
The 5-4 theory?
Yes.
What is the advantage?
Like the weak theory contractions, you never get a.
But there are definitely operators in the 5-4 theory that have non-zero 3-point functions. Say, phi cube. Okay, yes.
So we're talking about it's the 3-point functions for all the operators on the spectrum.
For all, technically it's for all the primary operators. Another thing that's remarkable at CFTs is that even though you have an infinite list of operators, you will say this is hopeless, you will never be able to compute them. It turns out that you only need to know the 3-point function of a special class of operator, which we will study in the detail, which are called the primary operators. These are kind of the basic building blocks of the theory. And the 3-point functions, or all the higher functions of all the other ones, can be trivially, quote unquote, trivially written in terms of the 3-point functions of the primaries. More questions? And the reason this is interesting is that actually in the last few years, in the exotic subject of string theory, of string theory and quantum field theory, supersymmetric quantum field theory, it has become apparent that there is a large set of quantum field theories that we still don't understand very well that are fundamentally not formulated in terms of a Lagrangian. We don't know how to think of them in terms of a Lagrangian. We have a lot of evidence they exist. And, an important research area in string theory, formal field theory, is to understand those theories. And in a way, conformal field theory is a baby version of that, where you can abstractly think of the theory without ever referring to Lagrangian. And the hope is that understanding this better will give us hints of how to actually formulate more fundamentally theories without Lagrangians that appear in string theory. Sorry, you had a question, yeah?
I was agreeing with Brilliant. Like, if you have phi 3, phi 3, phi 3, surely that's 9 fields, which again gives you 0.
But I would say that there's certainly operators in five, in lambda 5 to the 4th that have non-trivial three-point functions. So it, some of them will be zero, some of them will not be zero.
Okay. Take your word for
it. Check it.
Okay.
Yes? It comes quantized already. But to really discuss this in more detail, maybe let's postpone that because it will be the subject of several lectures later on. Okay, another important motivation for CFTs, which I kind of already mentioned here, is that conformal field theories provide our best understanding of quantum gravity. And this is in the framework of the ADCFT correspondence, which you will have a complete course in it, but just to give you very roughly what the idea is. You study quantum gravity in a space which has certain boundary conditions, a certain asymptotic behavior, very far away from you. So if you're sitting here, there is a, very far away, there is a boundary. And the boundary condition is called anti-de Sitter. This is really the space, maximally symmetric space with negative curvature. And here you have, in the bulk, you have a box. So you can think of this as a can of soup. Inside the can, anything can happen. In fact, the theory here is quantum gravity. You can have formation of black holes, singularities, cosmic singularities, whatever you want. And the statement of the correspondence, which, even though it has not been proven, appears to be true beyond any reasonable doubt, is that all the physics inside this box, all the complications of quantum gravity, have an interpretation or formulation in terms of a conformal field theory that lives at the boundary of the box. So it lives in one dimension less. So if this quantum gravity lives in D plus one dimensions, since the quantum field theory lives at the boundary, I have to fix one direction because I have to go to the boundary. So this is a conformal field theory in D dimensions. Okay? So in principle, by completely solving conformal field theories on the boundary, we can answer any question that we want in quantum gravity in this box, essentially. And this is the important subject of ADCFT, and this has had a large number of spin-offs with applications to hydrodynamics, condensed matter physics, essentially to everything. I mean, somehow ADCFT now is being used to solve or to try to phrase any problem where the usual methods of perturbation theory break down. One can try to rephrase them in terms of some gravitational description, and that's a very active area of research. And finally, which is also something that you will see in one of your courses, conformal field theory. So this was a fancy, if you wish, or more modern application of CFTs to quantum gravity or string theory, a more traditional approach of conformal field theory to string is its connection to string theory, perturbative string theory. So you will have a course on string theory, and you should grill the lecturer there. But the basic idea here is that the classical solutions of string theory, so this is a theory where the basic building blocks in perturbation theory are not particles but strings. So instead of having the usual word line of a particle, you have world sheets. This time. And on these world sheets, there is a two-dimensional quantum field theory living on it. You have a string, and you can define a two-dimensional surface which geometrically you should think of as the world sheet as opposed to the world line of the string. And the formalism of string theory tells you that the classical solutions are described by two-dimensional conformal field theories. So string theory lives only
in very special vacua or solutions. And the vacua that it likes to live are precisely, it's not any old vacua. So string theory, despite what you might think, is not, is very rigid. And it can only make sense in theories that that two-dimensional field theory that lives on the wall sheet is a conformal field theory. And something that's very appealing about the subject is that by, in fact, demanding that the theory here on the wall sheet is a conformal field theory, you recover out of the blue Einstein's equations of general relativity. To be more precise and honest, a generalization of that. But this is, I guess, the subject of a different course. But I guess in the first two lectures, I wanted to kind of give a broad perspective on the applicability and importance of CFT to very different areas of physics. And tomorrow, even if I haven't collapsed, we will continue. We will start really from zero and developing the formalism of conformal field theories. And later on, our ultimate goal, in some sense, the goal of this course will be to try to reach to a point where we can calculate the critical exponents of various systems like the Ising model using two-dimensional CFTs. Any questions? Yes. No, but in relation, I meant that Einstein gravity, in principle, only has the graviton. But string theory comes with all kinds of extra fields. There's something called the dilaton. But the gravitational part of it is just Einstein gravity. But it's Einstein gravity plus scalars plus Gates fields. Any other questions? Okay, see you tomorrow.
So I should probably say we've got a tutorial at 1:45 in the King Street building again. Just like yesterday. Everybody's welcome.